Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kalinske. Culture,
comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends,
pop.
This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Hey, everybody, welcome to episode 77 of the Culture Pop Podcast. I'm Steve Mason along with Sue Kalinske, and today we've got our first returning guest on the show for the second time. He got his big start, of course, in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Since then, he's done films like Speed and Twister and Bad Boys. He was part of the long-running show Spin City, and now he's hit television gold. He is part of the best ensemble cast, which is on the best show on television. That is Succession. Alan Ruck is here. Alan, thanks a lot for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
So did you realize you had done this show before?
No. When my manager brought it to my attention, I was like, right. But I didn't, when we first lined this up, I didn't really remember. But, you know, I'm an older guy and I have young children and I don't sleep enough. And so that's my excuse.
Easy to forget.
No. Yeah, I like you guys. I just, you know, there's always something else to think about here.
Sure. You said that you've got young children. How has the pandemic been for you? Have you been playing teacher?
My wife has been shouldering that burden by and large, which is going to change up here in a little while because she goes back to work the same time I do in November. And the kids are going to be with me for about 6 weeks. So it's going to be up to daddy. So my wife has been really doing a good job. But she's a Virgo, you know, and she's all about keeping things in order and on schedule. I'm a Cancer, and we don't roll like that. So it's going to be some freeform school, I think, for a while.
Have you come up with any new skills during the pandemic?
No, I've just grown out my beard. I actually didn't bother to cut my hair or my beard. For months and months, and then the hair just really started to get to me. It was unpleasant. So I got the haircut, but I still have the, I'm working on my ZZ Top whiskers here.
Yeah, the hair is out of control for me too. One of these days I'm going to actually break through and get a haircut. My guy, I think, opened this last week, so now I've got a shot. So your character on Succession, which is a show, you know, from the introduction that we absolutely love. In season one, your character tried to run for president. Then he tried to succeed on Broadway with his sort of girlfriend. The last time you were here, you talked about sort of some kind of delusionary psychology sort of thing with him. What's going on inside Connor's head?
Well, you know, they're all so damaged. All of the kids, even Connor, you know, in his 50s, all he really wants is his daddy's approval. And the thing is, Connor never had any business skill. And, you know, the old man divorced Connor's mother when Connor was about 8 years old. And so I think Connor, you know, before that knew that he was a little prince. And when he was with daddy, you know, doors opened and people were very attentive. And then he got stuck living with his mother for the next 10 years, and there had been hints that she was had some big mental challenges, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was all that happy. I think, you know, lots of money, lots of privilege, very little love. So Connor is just, he's kind of frozen in time at 8 years old, really. If you think about it, he hasn't really, talk about arrested development. He just hasn't, you know, kind of moved off that boyhood, you know, make-believe thing.
Yeah, so he's got a spiritual retreat center in New Mexico where the family all get together one time. I'm curious, in Connor's head, is he really spiritual or is it all for show?
I actually, you know, I think he gets carried away with stuff. I mean, this is a guy who's never worked a day in his life because he's just got this big, fat trust fund. You know, he has never had to work a day in his life. And I think maybe when Connor was younger, he tried a few things and it just didn't work out. So then, you know, one thing and another, and he's got the money to do it. He just indulges his current whims, you know, whatever strikes his fancy. So I don't think that I don't think it's all for show. I mean, I do think he wants to find something that will impress the old man. But, you know, I mean, that's like wishing to go to the moon. But I don't think it's all for show. I just think he's spoiled and he can do whatever he wants.
How much do you actually know about the arc of a season?
Okay, I want you to put your thumb and your forefinger together and like an okay sign, and then look at that shape. And that's exactly how much we get to know in terms of what's going to happen in the upcoming season. Brian Cox, I believe, gets to know a few things. I wrote to him the other day and I said, have you seen any pages? And he wrote back, no. And I could see the smile in his text, you know, like, no, no. Brian gets to know some things. Maybe Jeremy gets to know something here and there. But the rest of us, we just wait for those scripts to come in and then we know.
You know, your cast is so good with Brian Cox, number one on the call sheet. When the director yells cut, does everybody stay in character? What's it like on the set?
Well, different people have different approaches. I mean, I think it's pretty well known now that Jeremy Strong tends to stay in his zone. And, you know, you got to respect that. You got to, if that's what the guy needs to do, because he delivers beautiful work, right? So if that's what a person needs to do to be comfortable, to feel like they're going to give their best performance, then you just got to, honor that, you know. Other people are cracking jokes and, you know, Matthew McFadden is, you know, this classically trained British lean man, you know, almost like a swashbuckler type. And he's the biggest banana you've ever met. You know, if anybody like flubs the line, if anybody messes up, you know, Matthew is always the first one to start giggling. I mean, almost always. So it's, he's a lot, everybody's a joy to work with. I got to tell you, I love this group. But Jeremy tends to stay in his zone, and everybody else, you know, if they have something serious to do, if there's some, big thing coming up for somebody in any given scene, you can see them go off and be by themselves for a little while and collect their thoughts, whatever it is they need to do. But, we all just do it a little bit differently.
What's the process during, like before you shoot a scene, do you rehearse the scene? And I'm asking this because last weekend on 60 Minutes, they replayed an interview with Joaquin Phoenix, and he said he doesn't like to rehearse. It feels fake. And he feels like, you know, when you try to recapture that moment, he said it just doesn't work for him. Well, what are your feelings about that?
Well, you know, he's at a certain level that I am not at. And if I ever felt really uncomfortable, like, I know I don't want to rehearse this, I just do it with the stand-ins, and I'm going to come in and just do it cold and just, you know, feel it out on camera for the first time. If I was adamant about that, our directors, especially Mark Mylod, would be like, he'd say, okay, mate, you know, go ahead. But I don't generally have that problem, you know. The cameraman, the you know, the director of photography and the director need to see how things are going to line up, because we're usually shooting at least two cameras at a time and sometimes three and four, you know, depending on what we're doing. And that's a lot of choreography if you have scenes with big people, just to make sure you're not in anybody's, you know, way. So I don't mind rehearsal. I just like to rehearse for the moves. Like, you do your beginning of your speech here, and then you move over here to where the drinks are, and you pour yourself a drink, and then you finish your lines from there. You know, that kind of just bare bones rehearsal I find very helpful. But actually running a scene over and over and over and over before you shoot it, I hate that.
Which character on the show do you think has got the most redeeming value? I mean, everybody's a snake, but who's got the most redeeming value?
I think Jerry. I mean, I think she knows where all the bodies are buried.
Sure.
But there's something about in the way that Jay plays her that I'm like, you are almost a human being. You are almost. There just might be a heart, you know, inside that chest. You know, everybody has, I think younger people especially, have such high hopes for Cousin Greg. But, you know, I mean, I think he's shown himself to be as potentially nasty as any of them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's learned.
Yep.
I'm playing hardball, and, you know, I'm going to cover my own ass. I think Tom's love for Shiv is real. I do think that Shiv, in her way, loves Tom and needs him. She needs that person who's going to, you know, be there for her when she's a mess, you know. But she just, what's that thing? She'd never want to be a member of a club that would have her as a member. What is that? Never want to belong to a club that would have her as a member?
Sure. I would never want to be a member of a club that would have me, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah. You know, I think she's got that thing going on in her life, and it's like, yes, I need Tom, and I need him to be there for me, but, oh, look at him, you know, and she's just, you know, I don't know what the actual character defect, or even if it is one, but, I mean, if it is if you're carrying on affairs, and then you tell your husband that, you know, on your wedding night, by the way, I do this stuff on the side, that's problematic, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, if they're okay with it, whatever. But I do think that his, now another thing that's interesting though, I do think that he loves her, but if she wasn't the daughter of a billionaire, I don't know if he'd stick around, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something in it for him more than just romance.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I actually have, of all people, I have great hope for Roman.
Huh?
I have great hope for Roman. In the second season, some things happened that were pretty scary for him, and he handled them well, and he was present enough to come away with the truth of what that particular business opportunity was or wasn't. And it's for the first time we've ever seen Roman be on the ball, you know, just like, no, he totally got it. He totally nailed that. So, I want to see what's going to happen with him. You know, I mean, Kendall is fucked up for life. I'm sorry. Yeah. I mean, who knows what's going to happen now that he's, you know, thrown the old man under the bus, but, you know, life is not going to be happy for him. He's never going to be happy.
For all that you don't know, have there been any storylines that made you say, whoa, I totally didn't see that coming?
Well, in the first season, you know, Kendall was a train wreck, and he was just, you know, he was kind of, you know, walking through self-made disaster one after another. But I really didn't see the thing about the kid being killed. That was a big surprise. And actually then we didn't know what was going to happen, but Kendall blaming everything on the old man at the end of season two. This is something that Jesse Armstrong and our gang of writers excel at. You know, there's always people trying to like second guess, or, you know, like the TV mavens that are like, I know what's going to happen. You know what's going to happen? They're making predictions. That's a fool's errand, because with these writers, you're never going to know until it happens.
Here's a theory I want to float by you. So Kendall threw Logan under the bus at the end of season two.
Yeah.
Do you think that do you think Kendall was doing what Logan wanted him to do?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, that's an interesting theory that there's this sort of like master chess players, you know, most daring and brilliant move. I don't know that they have like some, that he manipulated him into doing that, or that they have some secret code, some secret language. It's like, this is what you're going to do and everything's going to be cool. It's going to work out fine. I don't know about that, because Logan, you know, he's a survivor. That guy is a survivor. And I don't know about going through all those gyrations on the yacht about who are we going to sacrifice.
Yeah.
You know, but you know what? Like I'm saying, you could be absolutely right.
Yeah, who knows?
I have no way of knowing which way Jesse is going to twist it.
Yeah, there was that hint of a smile. Steve, I was actually thinking the same thing. Was it a sign of, like, bring it on? You know, like, oh, I taught him well, you know, like, touche. Okay, now this is going to get really interesting between us.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some of that in there because he told him he wasn't a killer. He said, you know, it's just, you're not a killer. I mean, he's told him over and over, like in the first season, he said, you should collect sports cars or write a book, but you're not made for this business, you know. And then, you know, he just told him on the yacht that you're not a killer. You're not a killer. And then to see him do that, whether it was Logan's plan all along, I have no idea. But I do think there was some little flicker of respect, like, you really are a little motherfucker. You are, maybe you're a lot more like me than I thought.
Yeah. So on that note, I want to ask you about John Hughes, who you worked with on Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and who made the movies of my growing up years, whether it was 16 Candles or Breakfast Club. What kind of guy was John Hughes?
I think he was, sort of typify him as a moody genius. He had his own particular genius when it came to those films, and my God, could he write. You know, he knocked off 16 Candles in a weekend. I think he did Ferris Bueller in under a week. You know, he just had it. That was just a gift. And I don't think too many things would get changed, you know. I mean, pretty much from what his first draft, the shooting script was usually pretty tight. It was just stuff usually that they couldn't shoot because, like on Bueller, there was supposed to be a scene where we went to a strip club and Cameron fell in love with a stripper. And, you know, Ferris has a monologue about Cameron and what a disaster he's going to be in relationships and all this kind of stuff. And we were actually down in Long Beach shooting the swimming pool stuff. And the suits came from Paramount to see John at lunch. And then after lunch, John was in a real bad mood because they had told him, John, we love the dailies. We love everything you're doing, but you have this many days left, which meant he had to cut something. So, you know, I mean, he was still at that point when we did that movie. He wasn't really at the point where he could write his own ticket. You know, he still had to answer to people in terms of, like, budget, you know, and schedule and things like this. And then after the Home Alone movies, then, you know, everybody left him alone. And they just, whatever he wanted to do was okay with them. But he was still under some pressure at Paramount because Pretty in Pink hadn't come out yet. The 16 Candles and... what else? Breakfast Club. I'm pretty sure those were at Universal. Pretty in Pink and Ferris Bueller were his first two with Paramount. So, and Pretty in Pink hadn't come out yet. So they just, you know, they were just doing what they do. Reminding people of where money comes from and, you know, it doesn't grow on trees and all that.
A moment of honesty here, Alan. So when I was a kid, my dad was, my late dad, was a lot like, Cameron's dad, who we never actually see in the movie, but my dad put a ton of pressure on me when I was growing up. And so I took a lot of solace in the experience that Cameron has in that movie. Have you heard from people that have sort of that story, that theme?
Yeah, I've definitely heard from some people who had overbearing fathers and how tough it was, especially for them in their teen years before they left home. So yeah, there've been other people who've commented on that. And so I'm sorry that you had that experience. Because who needs it?
Do you have to like a character in order to play it?
Well, actually, I don't think you need to like it per se, but you have to love it. So, especially if it's a really good part, you just have to understand why they do what they do. And you might play someone despicable, but if you can figure out why they think like they do, you'll really come to enjoy spending time doing that. You know, I mean, So I think it's kind of like, especially if it's a wonderful part, it's just like something that you love, but you don't particularly like them. I mean, it could be like a, you know, member of your family, you know?
Yeah. Or
right.
Something like that. You love them, but, you know.
So I had this in my notes from the last time we talked, and it may be true. I have no idea where I found it, so I'll throw it out there, and you tell me if it's real. You were in the movie Class. It also starred John Cusack, Rob Lowe, Virginia Madsen, Andrew McCarthy. And at some point, this is what I read, there was a piece of physical comedy that went completely wrong. Is that true?
Yeah. Cusack and I got in trouble because there was this sequence where the boys went to the girls' school for tea or some crap, I don't know. And there was the headmistress, was this lovely Chicago actress named Fern Persons. And she was holding this tea, and we're all much, you know, very much being ladies and gentlemen. And then the gag was that, I can't remember the character's name. This is terrible. I blanked. Andy McCarthy. Can't remember the character. Andy McCarthy stands up and loses his balance, and he to keep himself from falling, he grabs Virginia Madsen's blouse, and then he falls, and so her blouse rips and her boob falls out. And then he hits, on the way down, he hits a tray full of canapes with his elbow, and it works like a catapult, and it plasters the headmistress, you know, with like finger sandwiches and, you know, eclairs and shit. But it was extended. It seemed like it took like, you know, like 20 seconds. It took a while to complete all the gags. And so our director said to Cusack, well, to all of us, he said, you boys go ahead and laugh when you see this going on. But at the very end, you have to shut up, because Rob has a line and we want to get it in the clear. We don't want to have to, you know, loop it or anything. We want to get it in the clear. We want to do it all in one. And so this thing goes off, you know, and Gina Madsen's boob falls out and pastries are flying through the air. It was some really good physical comedy. They really set it up well. Well, Cusack and I got the snorts, and we started laughing like hell, and we didn't rein it in. We did not rein it in. So we laughed over Rob's line, and after the take, Lou Carlino, the director, chewed me and John out in front of everybody. He just chewed our asses out in front of the whole crew, you know, for screwing up the take, because they so desperately wanted to have it with his line with no other noise. So then we set it all up and we did it again, and that time, you know, we kept quiet. But anyway, it's just one of those. The stories of being a journeyman actor.
So when you work so closely with actors on a series or a film shoot, what would you say is the percentage of longtime friendships that you've maintained?
Well, I made a bunch on Spin City. First of all, I worked with Matthew on stage in a Neil Simon play before we did Bueller. And so that was a very special time in my life, like that Broadway show and then going right into that movie. So we don't see each other that often, but we're constantly texting and emailing and stuff, Broderick and I. So we're still pals. And I have a very good friend named Matt Mulhern that I met on Biloxi Blues on the Neil Simon play. He's actually, at 60 years old, he's going for his doctorate in history. So he's taking a different direction. But yeah. I mean, he's in class with people that are like 29 years old and he's 60. But anyway, I'm really proud of him. But then I made a lot of friends on Spin City. Michael Boatman and I had been in a show for the old WB network called Muscle. And then about a year later, you know, we were cast again together in Spin. And I'm still friends with Michael Fox. I'm really good friends with Barry Boswick and Michael Boatman and Richard Kind. I still talk to Sandy Chaplin. I made some pretty good friends.
Your show Spin City, you played Stuart, who is kind of, I was looking at some highlights on the YouTube, is a pretty lecherous character. And if you go back and you look at it, do you think that would fly in 2020?
No, I sure don't. I mean, We did the last, well, we started it 24 years ago. Is that right? Yeah, we did it in 96. So, you know, that's a long time, and a lot of things have changed. And a lot of stuff that we got away with, I just think there would be so much mail of like hashtag me too, that they would shut that down pretty quickly. I don't think it would ever get off the ground right now. I don't think it would work.
Yep.
Have you ever turned down a role because the subject matter was displeasing?
No, I've just turned stuff down because it was stupid more than anything.
Good choice.
Yeah.
You starred on a show called The Exorcist for Fox. Do you believe in demonic possession and exorcists and all that business?
I think there's more stuff going on in the universe than we have any idea about. So I don't count any of that out. I don't tend to see devils, you know, all over my house or, you know, but I do believe that there's other stuff going on that we're not aware of at our particular level of consciousness.
Speaking of creepy stuff, you got a creepy movie coming out called Freaky. It's a horror film from Blumhouse. There's a lot of buzz around it. What can you tell us about it?
It's kind of a really gnarly spin on the Freaky Friday idea that, you know, souls can swap bodies. And so we have Vince Vaughn. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about this.
Well, don't get in trouble.
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about this. I'm sorry. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I saw the trailer for it, so I know what the premise is.
Oh, okay. Well, then you know more than I do because I haven't seen any. it's just, you know, a horrid killer swaps bodies with a beautiful high school girl with hilarious results.
Do you think movie going, I mean, we're talking about movies, your movie, I don't know if it's coming out in theaters or if it's going to stream or what it is, but you know, in the wake of this pandemic, and I used to own movie theaters, and a lot of my friends are independent theater owners and they're all going through a really bad time. Do you think movie going is ever going to be the same?
Yeah, I do think it'll come back. I mean, as soon as some sort of vaccine is available and as soon as they get the science together on what sort of therapies they can use and they get better at diagnosing this crap, I think we are going to slide back into something that's a lot more like normal. I mean, it could be that there's people just get used to social distancing. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that, like in Hong Kong, people just wear masks when they go outside or they go on the subway or whatever. As they still do to this day after SARS or, you know, did before COVID hit. So maybe stuff like that will go on. But I do think that I think life goes on and I think we're going to regroup. I think we're going to get through it and then we're going to go back to life as close to normal or as close to as how we remember it, you know, as we can.
So last thing for you. Where are we on season 3 of Succession? Have you seen any scripts? Is there a production date? Is there anything?
No. We are going to start shooting in November. We're going to start shooting in November. And that's
awesome.
That's what we know. Yep. And I don't have any idea about when it might be aired. I have no idea.
Well, we miss it.
We do. We miss it terribly.
And by the way, I would be stunned. The Emmys are Sunday night. I would be stunned if it doesn't win Best Drama Series. I would be stunned.
I think we have a real shot. And so many of my castmates are, you know, nominated. I think we ought to come away with something.
You know, you mentioned something the other day that the Emmys they're doing, first of all, it's a really weird Emmy ceremony. Jimmy Kimmel's doing it and I guess it's going to be by Zoom and all that stuff. But you mentioned something about acceptance speeches, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, I think what they have to do is all the nominees have to pre-record. I'm not sure, but I think they might have to pre-record an acceptance speech. I don't know how else they do it. Because, you know, I mean, there's people all over the world. Like, Sarah Snook right now is in Australia, you know, which is where she's from, but she actually lives in New York now, but she got stuck in Australia, you know, by COVID. And so I don't know how else they would do it. I don't know exactly. Well, but I think
that's fascinating that after the awards, if you don't win, this will exist, this acceptance speech that nobody is ever going to hear. That is crazy.
Well, you know, we could maybe get a bunch of them together and sell it, you know, as a little.
It's a good idea. Sell them as a package. Sure. Yep, sure. Yep. Hey, listen, Alan, it is really good to have you back on the show, and we appreciate your time an awful lot. We had a little technical snafu earlier in the week, and you were good enough to come back, and we appreciate that a lot. We wish you great luck. We're looking forward to season 3 of Succession, and we're looking forward to the Emmy for Best Drama Series, and maybe one of your castmates winning on Sunday night at the Emmys.
All right, I sure appreciate it. Thank you.
There you have it, Alan Ruck. Fantastic guy, Sue.
Oh, what a sweetie. Really like him.
Let the story be told that we tried to do this a couple of days ago, and we struggled. Something happened bad technically, and he could not have been a nicer guy about it, and we were able to reschedule. And he is on a show that, I mean, I absolutely crave. Like, I'm so bummed that we're not going to get it for at least a year now. It's my favorite show on TV.
You know, one thing that we didn't talk about that I wanted to ask him, what the hell is going on with Roman and Jerry?
Oh, that's some weird stuff.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that is weird. Whatever is going on there.
I didn't see that coming at all.
No, not at all. Not at all. The Emmys are Sunday night. Sue, any final thoughts before we get to the Emmy Award ceremony?
No, I'm going with everything that I talked about. You know, I think Schitt's Creek is going to pick up a lot of awards, and I've been catching up with it. So,
how do you like it?
Oh my God!
It's such a good show.
It's so funny, and I tell you, I just can't take Catherine O'Hara.
I don't understand.
I mean, I know we've got someone coming up. We have Sarah Levy coming on soon. So I'll save all of that for that podcast. But it's just hysterically funny. The writing is great. And
it's got such a good heart, too.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah. Yeah. You know who introduced me to that show? My mom and my not stepdad, Leo. They said, you've got to watch Schitt's Creek. And I said, we've tried it. And we probably did try it an episode or two. But we started it again and got completely addicted and raced through, I think it was 6 seasons in about 2 weeks.
Well, I felt the same way. I watched an episode or two, and I really wasn't hooked. And everybody was like, oh, you got to watch it. So here I am watching it.
Here you are. And you're right. Sarah Levy is going to join us on the podcast. She's actually the guest for episode 78. This is episode 77. Congratulations, Sue. Episode 77. Who would have thunk we would have lasted this long?
I certainly didn't. No, I'm kidding.
Did you really not?
No, I'm kidding. No, I've always believed in us, you know, and this goes back to, you know, the days when we were doing a radio show together. It's something that I always wanted to recapture with you because I knew that we would have so much fun, and especially without any constraints.
Yes.
That was the key. And it's been a blast.
Yeah, it's been great. So we will tell you that episode 78 will be Sarah Levy, who is Eugene Levy's daughter. Dan Levy's sister plays Twyla on Schitt's Creek. That's coming up for you, our next podcast. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening. We appreciate it a lot. Enjoy the Emmys. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. You can do that at stevemason.com, where the podcast is always available. Thanks a lot, Sue.
Thank you, Steve.
And we will see everybody next time.
Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode of Culture Pop.